This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Coming up on the program today, the big economic what if of the Iran deal. Kids go night clubbing, what could possibly go wrong? And make mine tag-alongs, please. The CEO of the Girl Scouts is going to be here later on from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 6th of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The White House is a long way from any place with that framework nuclear agreement with Iran. There are some very skeptical audiences the president will have to convince on this thing, including, but not limited to, the Congress of the United States and allies like Israel and Saudi Arabia. But that said, if, and grant you this is a very big if, Iran does eventually get out from under in one way or another its decades-long economic isolation, it could well become a regional economic power over there. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off.
Consider a few figures from the CIA, the World Bank, and the like. Iran has the third biggest proven oil reserves in the world, the biggest natural gas reserves, among the most zinc and lead, plus plenty of copper, iron, and coal. Daniel Yergin analyzes energy economics at IHS.
If sanctions are removed, then you could see a country that becomes quite dynamic and would be seen as the next big emerging market.
Here's more potential. Iran's got well-developed industry compared to its Middle East neighbors, auto plants, food production, telecom, and 75 million consumers, many of them middle class, attuned to Western products and styles. Iran expert Kaveh Ehsani at DePaul University.
So the human resources are tremendous. The higher education system is very good, and the Iranian students are highly motivated.
But now come the obstacles, big obstacles, for Iran to become a significant player in global markets. Let's start with natural gas. There's been speculation Iran could knock out Russia as the major supplier to Europe. But, says energy analyst Stephen Shork, sanctions have left Iran's infrastructure in disrepair. It doesn't have pipelines or liquid natural gas plants to get the gas to market.
I'm skeptical that Iran can compete with Russia or Qatar or Australia or the United States.
And sanctions, plus Iran's centralized theocratic government, have suffocated the private sector and bred corruption, which will be hard to dislodge whether sanctions are lifted or not. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All righty, this just in from the Marketplace desk of poorly kept secrets. Tomorrow, Senator Rand Paul is expected to formally announce that he is running for president. The Kentucky Republican tweeted out a YouTube video last night showing highlights of his political career, so take that for what it's worth. Paul, if you're counting, would be the second candidate to officially announce, thus making him the second candidate subject to certain campaign finance laws. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more on why waiting can be so profitable.
Want to run for president? Shh, keep it quiet. Don't even say you're testing the waters, because once you form an exploratory committee or outright announce you're running, bam, there are limits on how much money you can raise and how you can spend it. So presidential hopefuls act like candidates, but don't make it official.
The 2016 election is shaping up so far to be the biggest joke under the campaign finance laws.
That's Larry Noble, former general counsel at the Federal Election Commission, or FEC.
It's an arms race. When some candidates do it, the other candidates think, unless I act the same way, I'm just going to get swamped.
And you know what? They're right. Because as long as you're not an official candidate for president, you can raise millions of dollars for your super PAC and coordinate with it closely. Bob Biersack worked at the FEC for 30 years.
You can say, here are five people I want you to hire. You can say, you should be advertising in these states, and these are the messages you should use.
Once a candidate makes it official, that game plan goes out the window, and you have to publicly report how much money you've raised. Bierczak and Noble are now advocates of campaign finance reform. Dan Backer is on the other side of the spectrum. He's a conservative lawyer who brought a Supreme Court challenge to campaign finance regulations. He says the law is clear and says reformers are just complaining that the spirit of the law isn't being followed.
The law doesn't have a spirit. It has ink and it has paper, and we need to do exactly what the law says it is to be compliant.
And even if the FEC was worried the non-presidential candidates weren't being compliant and decided to look into whether anyone was breaking the law, any investigations would take years and wouldn't be finished until after the 2016 presidential election. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, real slow start, pretty strong finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are, what, a week or so from tax day, right? 9 days, something like that. And while there is still time to get your paperwork done, most of the tax-qualifying events, as they're known for this year's return, were locked in back on New Year's Eve. So if 2014 was the year you tied the knot, well, to about a third or so of you newly married couples, welcome to the first year of what is being called the marriage tax penalty that you will have to deal with. Audrey Quinn explains what it is and how it came to pass.
When Adina DeMonte first met her boyfriend, Dan, he put one thing on the table. One day, he wanted to be married. His own parents had never tied the knot, and he'd grown up wanting to have marriage in his life.
So from day one of our relationship, we literally had this conversation. I basically committed to him that, you know, not then, but one day, I would get married.
Fast forward 9 years, they've got good careers in the tech industry, an apartment together in Mountain View, and DeMonte's started to feel ready to make good on that marriage promise. Now, there's one thing you should know about her. She's a total finance nut, so much that she thought she'd broach the marriage conversation with Dan by talking about tax savings.
Kind of to tease him a little bit about, well, we're waiting so long. If we were married, we would save X number of dollars this year and next year.
But when DeMonte looked up that number of dollars online, she found that if she and Dan got married this year, they'd actually pay about $1,000 more in taxes than they would as single people. If they both make more money down the line, they could get an even higher tax penalty for being married. It suddenly didn't seem very responsible.
We both said, wow, that's crazy.
The marriage penalty comes from basically a botched attempt to make taxes more fair. Up until the 1940s, couples would file as individuals. But around World War II, when the top income tax rate was super high, some rich couples were figuring out a trick. Say one spouse made $100,000 a year, the other made nothing. If they split that, like report each spouse made $50,000, they'd dodge the highest tax bracket. Pretty sweet deal, but maybe not so fair.
So the result in 1948 was actually just to accept that benefit and give it to every married couple.
That's Stephanie McMahon from the University of Cincinnati College of Law. She means letting every couple file jointly.
So that every married couple could shift income from one spouse and split it between both spouses.
But single people started saying, hey, no fair, why do married people get to save money on taxes?
So in 1969, single individuals managed to get a reduced tax bracket compared to joint filers.
The little known singles bonus. But here's the problem. If someone's in a marriage where both people make a similar amount of money, they don't get any benefit from shifting their income between spouses. So they pay more taxes than everyone else. This isn't just a rich people problem. The cutoffs for certain tax benefits, like the earned income tax credit, are lower for two married people than they are for two single people. So lower income married couples can get penalized too. James Alm's an economist at Tulane University, and he's found a small but significant impact of the marriage penalty on people's marriage decisions.
A 10% increase in the marriage penalty decreases the likelihood of your getting married by 1% or 2%.
But it's more about the principle of the thing to him.
It's just kind of the notion of fairness. Is it appropriate that people's taxes should change positively or negatively simply because they're getting married?
Alm would prefer we go back to a system where everyone files as an individual. He's seeing that as a trend in other countries right now. And meanwhile, Adina DeMonte's still weighing her options.
If anyone out there can convince me that I should get married, please do, because I want to get married. But it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense right now.
In New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Think of me like the principal of the Girl Scouts for the whole world.
She's nicer than that. The CEO of the Girl Scouts of the USA coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 117 points today, about 2/3%, closed at 17,880. The NASDAQ jumped 30 points, 0.6%, ended things at 49.17. The S&P 500 up 13 points, about 2/3%, finished at 2080 there. Rising crude prices today lifted several energy boats. Chevron sloped up 1.5%. ExxonMobil moved up about 1% or so. Tesla Motors, man, get a load of this. They charged up 6.3% after the electric car maker reported a 55% increase in deliveries in the first quarter. U.S.-listed shares of gene therapy company uniQure leapt 47%. The Dutch firm struck a deal with pharmaceutical giant Bristol-Myers Squibb to develop gene therapies. BMS slipped about 1/3% on the news. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.89%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues job openings and labor turnover data for February. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release its monthly consumer credit report for February. And jazz singer Billie Holiday was born 100 years ago on April 7th, 1915. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The law of supply and demand is in full effect in the corn harvest this year. We've got more of it than we know what to do with, thanks in part to high prices the past couple of years, which, in accordance with the law, pretty much obliged farmers to plant more corn. There is a new study out showing farmers converted millions of acres of grassland to plant corn, which comes, it turns out, with big environmental costs, specifically for our carbon footprint. Marketplace's Dan Weissman explains.
Isn't corn a plant? Aren't plants good for taking carbon out of the atmosphere? That was my first question for Tyler Lask. He's a researcher at the University of Wisconsin and the study's lead author. He said it has to do with microbes that lie dormant in the prairie's undisturbed soil. Plow the soil, they wake up.
And so when they go through that process, just like humans, they also release CO2 when they exhale, in a sense.
So there's a one-time release. Plus, harvesting annual crops like corn stores less carbon in the soil than allowing perennials like grass to stay put. That's the biology. Then there's markets and government policy. Last year's Farm Bill cut back a program that pays farmers to set aside land for conservation.
And so now that prices have dropped, farmers may be left with no alternative but to continue cropping this land.
Remember that huge surplus? You know, prices have fallen dramatically. Then there's another government program, subsidized crop insurance. Most of that newly plowed land was eligible, and it wasn't great land for farming.
So I think you could point the finger directly at the crop insurance program for de-risking that land conversion decision.
That's Iowa State economist Bruce Babcock. He studies corn markets. He's less concerned about the carbon impacts than about the fact that some of this grassland provided a habitat for songbirds.
We can do lots of CO2 emission mitigation by simply converting coal-fired plants into natural gas or solar.
What he means is it's impossible to bring back species that are lost because you plowed under their habitat. I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
A lesson now in how not all identity theft is created equal. Your credit card number gets stolen, not all that big a deal. It's a problem, but you get a new one in the mail. Your medical data gets stolen, and it does. That's a whole nother thing, and in ways you might not even have thought of, as Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons tells us.
Back in January, the old way of doing medical records, papers stuffed into a filing cabinet, literally went up in flames in Brooklyn, New York. A 7-alarm fire ripped through a warehouse.
The paper inside this place has fueled the inferno. It's stacked from floor to ceiling with millions of documents, some from the city, including paperwork from courts and hospitals.
Those papers, with personal data clearly visible, fluttered all around New York and into the East River. City officials had to fish them out of the icy water with nets. With medical records increasingly digitized, it's not just fire or burglars, but hackers and identity thieves that consumers have to worry about. Dwayne Malanson, chief tech officer at Tripwire, says at first, health data hackers mostly looked for credit card and bank information.
But we've seen it evolve to really target personal data a lot more heavily, and that made medical records a lot much more attractive target.
Peter Robichaux, a healthcare security expert and author of a book on the same topic, says when criminals receive information, they often hold it and wait.
So someone might have had their information stolen, sold to the highest bidder, and they won't know that it's being used for another year or 2 years or 3 years.
Contrast that to getting your credit card number stolen. Sometimes you get a phone call within seconds after it's been used. But here's the real kicker. Your health data, be it stolen or surreptitiously gathered by some of those apps and devices, could end up being used in predictive consumer scores. They're like credit scores, but they predict different things about consumers.
In proclivity to commit fraud, their medication adherence score, their likely spend on healthcare score.
That's Frank Pasquale, professor of law at the University of Maryland. He says the industry is largely unregulated.
And under the veil of trade secrecy, they essentially say, look, we're not going to tell anybody what's in here.
Without more stringent data security and privacy rules, this problem isn't going to be over anytime soon. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Sometimes you hear about business ideas that make you go, okay. Here's today's entry, Kids in Nightclubs. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson heard about a company called CirKiz, that's C-I-R-K-I-Z, that hosts dance parties for kids inside Manhattan nightclubs. Clearly, she had to check it out, and she sent us this look behind the velvet rope.
Put your hands up!
Instead of house or trance music, it's mostly pop blaring from the speakers at Cielo, a nightclub in Manhattan's trendy meatpacking district. The music's loud, but not too loud. Waist-high kids in t-shirts and Converse fill the dance floor. They're coated in neon stickers with glow sticks wrapped around their necks and wrists.
Five, six, seven, go!
Professional dancers call out steps, while 7-year-old Atlas Gearson is busy covering himself in orange tape that glows under the club's lights. In a word, he thinks the party is
awesome.
And his favorite part?
Probably like the dance moves, maybe. Like crisscross like this.
He jumps and spins. For 8-year-old Jeremy Vanderhook, it's all about the novelty.
I've never been to a club before.
Crazy, right? Kids in a club. Jesse Sprague and his wife Jenny Song run these parties through their company, CirKiz. They say, actually, clubs are the perfect party spots, regardless of the age of the guest list.
Girls! You have all of these beautiful venues that are vacant during the day. They have sound systems, they have amazing light shows.
They have to meet strict fire and safety standards, and they come with their own security.
We joke with the bouncers when we come in for the first time because we say, you have the opposite job today. Your job is to keep everybody in.
Jesse used to manage nightclubs and met Jenny at the Limelight 2 decades ago at a birthday party for the fashion designer Jean-Paul Gaultier. So when they had a kid and wanted to throw a party for his first birthday, for them, the club seemed like a natural fit.
We invited all of our non-parent friends, and we invited all of our new mommies and daddy friends and their kids. And that was really sort of the spark of an idea that entered our mind, like,
forget the bouncy castle, forget Chuck E. Cheese. People would pay for this. It took them a few years, but they finally launched the business about 6 months ago. The model is pretty simple. Rent the clubs during the day when they'd usually be closed, hire some entertainers, add some decorations, offer food. And for parents like Christy Vanderhoek?
There's drinks for the adults, so that's always a plus, too. Alcoholic drink? Yes. Yet another reason why we're here.
The parties are $20 per person, parents and kids alike. Or, Jenny says, VIP group packages with extras could be a lot more.
Top tier could be around 1,000 or more.
CirKiz's last 3 monthly parties have sold out, 300 spots each. So now Jesse and Jenny are looking for opportunities to expand to larger clubs or possibly other cities. Here in New York, Mom Kelvio Rosario comes to this club, the grown-up version, every couple of months. It's one of her favorite night spots. So when she heard they were hosting kids' parties, she decided to bring her 5-year-old son, Osiel. She says he loves music.
And then he also did great at school. So I just want that he also parties, not only like homework and watching cartoons.
Osiel, dressed in a button-down shirt, was practically hugging his mom's leg. When I asked what he thought of the party, he whispered only the word shy. For some kids, the club life takes a little getting used to. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This is one of those radio stories where video is your friend. See it, believe it. The video is online at marketplace.org. Girl Scout cookie season has sadly come and gone, but don't fret because Girl Scout cookies are high on the list of things you can count on being there every year when you need them. There's an organization devoted to making that so and making a whole lot of other things happen for young girls as well besides just cookies. So on today's Conversations from the Corner office, Ana Maria Chavez. She is the CEO of the Girl Scouts of the USA. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You grew up a Girl Scout in Arizona. You get this job 4 years ago. Was it a tough sales pitch to get you to come run the place?
It wasn't. You know, I grew up in a small farming community, so I thought I knew about the land and the environment, but Girl Scouts put it in a very different context for me. And here I sit. I won't tell you how many decades later.
I won't ask, so, you know,
okay.
So it'll be fair. But the question I will ask is this. What does the CEO of the Girl Scouts of the USA do every day?
The way I explain it to my bosses, average age of my boss is about 8 years old. And I explain it to him this way, because sometimes it's hard to explain what you do to an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
And I say, you know, do you have a principal of your school? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, think of me like the principal of the Girl Scouts for the whole world.
But the principal's a bad person sometimes. You don't want to go see the principal. You get in trouble with the principal.
But what the principal does and what the CEO of Girl Scouts does is I'm their biggest advocate. I go out to local communities and talk to their local leaders about the need to invest in girls.
What is the most important investment in girls right now? And I'm not even talking necessarily financial, right? Because you can throw money at a problem till the cows come home.
Time.
Really?
Yes. The investment of an adult's time in a girl. Right now, sadly, I have about 30,000 girls on a wait list to be a Girl Scout.
Wow.
And the reality is because of the economy, people having to work two jobs, it's harder and harder for adults to find time to volunteer. And so right now we're looking for adults to lean in and help girls.
What do you want girls to get out of their scouting experience, whether they do it for a year when they're 10 years old or whether they go all the way up and get their it's the Gold Star Award, right?
The Gold Award, yes.
Gold Award, sorry. Yeah.
It's okay. It's the highest award you can earn in Girl Scouting. Well, one, I think they get several things out of Girl Scouts. One, they get a safe space to learn in with other girls. It also increases their self-confidence and also teaches them how to be team players. And I think that plays out really well in not only in school, but in the workforce. And you can see our Girl Scouts all across industries, and they're able to solve complicated issues and allow other people to lead on.
Do you worry, though, that scouting in a day when, you know, you've got the entire planet's knowledge on your phone in your pocket and there are so many other attractions or distractions, depending on how you want to look at it out there, do you worry that scouting comes off as anachronistic?
Well, you know, I think what's interesting, and you talk about technology and in the digital world that the girls are living in, you know, they're digital natives, and we clearly know that. And I'll be honest with you, my bosses, again, average age 8, you know, mm-hmm. they sit down with me. They come visit me in New York, and they say to me, you know, Ana, Eagle One, that's the moniker they've given me. They say, you know, we have iPads in school now. We use our phones in a very different way. Can you integrate this new 21st century technology with the way Girl Scouting is run these days? And I said, you know what? That's a good point. So just this year, and actually in conjunction with our Girl Scout program, we created the first ever digital cookie program. And it allowed girls to use their technology that they use every day to actually create their own business online.
All right. But so here's the comeback question. It's 2015. Where you been, man?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. First of all, it's all about safety with our girls, right? When we're talking about young girls, young women, we wanted to ensure that anything we built through technology was safe. In addition, it's a pretty complicated Girl Scout program. When you think about the millions of customers we touch every day during our Girl Scout cookie program and the transactions that happen, we had to ensure that customers felt comfortable giving us their visa numbers, and that girls mm-hmm. were also in a safe space to communicate with adults. So that took less than a year, but we wanted to take our time to make sure that was great, and we piloted it this year, and it went off extremely well.
Most important question of the interview coming up, what is your favorite cookie? Gotta pick one.
Samoa.
Really?
Yeah, I do have a favorite. I'm not supposed to because, you know, we have lots of cookies.
This just in.
It is, but my husband said, Anna, be real. You've got a favorite, and I do. It's called the Samoa.
Anna Maria Chavez, she is the CEO of the Girl Scouts of the USA. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today may be the real estate story to end all real estate stories. There's a new paper out from the Bureau of Economic Analysis in the Commerce Department about the value of land in the United States, all of the land in the United States, the 48 contiguous states. Anyway, that's the disclaimer. Here's the data. It all adds up to 1.89 billion acres worth $23 trillion with a T dollars in all. California is the most valuable state, Wyoming the least. That's dollar amounts. Please don't send nasty notes. Interestingly, the federal government owns 24% of all the land by area, just 8% by dollar value. All right, we're out of here. That is Marketplace for today. The Dow Industrials gained 117 points, about 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ up 30 points, 0.6% there. The S&P 500 gained 13 points, 2/3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.